Hello, and welcome to SF Crossing the Gulf. I'm Karen Burnham.
And I'm Karen Lord.
And we are here today to talk about two pieces of short fiction. Of course, we talk a lot about short fiction, but what we don't usually talk about is short fiction that would be classified as horror. But these are the pieces that that I'm going to blame Karen
for
we're talking about these today, but they are both just brilliant examples of craft.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one we're going to be talking about is The Good Husband by Nathan Ballingrud. And the mm-hmm. other one is a slightly older story. It's called The Fruit of My Woman. The author is Han Kang, and it's translated from Korean by Deborah Smith. So Karen, do you want to... Oh, did you want to talk at all about how you came across both these stories, or do you want to just jump right into the summary?
Actually, I would like to just mention briefly how I encountered both of them. First of all, The Good Husband, I was writing in residence at the Shared Worlds team writing camp back in, oh goodness, when was that? A while ago. And Nathan was also one of the instructors there. And we had an event at Malaprops, which is a bookstore in Asheville. And we're all doing our readings, and he did an excerpt from The Good Husband. And when he finished, I have never seen a room so chilled. And all of us writers up front, we just sort of looked at him aghast, because we were like, we can't precede that. We can't follow that. We might as well just pack up and go home right now. It was just so, it really just sort of like blew your mind. Everybody was like, wow, you know, and I was just, I was like, okay, you know what? I don't read horror, but I'm going to go buy this book right now. And you're going to, you know, give me a nice little inscription on the front, because that was the most amazing thing I ever heard. Well, I didn't gush quite that much, but I gushed a bit. I did. And as I said, I am not a person who enjoys horror, but I am a person who enjoys a story that operates on so many different levels. And I also really appreciate the level of craft he brought to it. So fast forward many, many years later to pretty much the present. Late last year, was it? Yep, late last year. And I am on Twitter, and I'm actually looking at the like suggestions under books, because, you know, Twitter knows what you like and they try and give you suggestions. And I see the Granta Twitter. Granta, of course, being the literary magazine. And we will give you the online link so that you can read The Fruit of My Woman for yourself. And I came across this link tweeted, and I thought, that's interesting. Because I think they gave you like the first line, and the first line just drew me in. And then I went and I read it, and I was like, oh my goodness. This is kind of surreal horror. This is really echoing so many of the themes in The Good Husband. And this is something that Karen is going to enjoy reading. And I think you know that I like DM'd you on the spot. I was like, read this.
Right, right. Like, you have to read this. Like, okay. Because
I don't do that too often, do I? You know,
when
something hits me, it really hits me. I'm like, no, you cannot. So that's the story of how I came across these two stories and why we're now bringing them to you. And one of the things we've decided to do is, as we always summarize the stories in advance. As I said, you can read the Fruit of My Woman online from the link we provide. You will have to buy Nathan's collection, North American Lake Monsters, published by Small Bear Press.
And let me just say, the multiple award-winning collection.
Yes, thank you. And there's a reason for that, yes. So what we're going to do is we're going to summarize them in a fairly bare-bones fashion, because we do want you to read them as examples of excellent use of language. I think both of them have extremely beautiful language, even if they have a horrific theme. Also, we're going to be digging deep into individual scenes as we go through the podcast. So we'll give you the main arc, and then we'll slot in these scenes in detail as we actually have the discussion, as opposed to making it too detailed in the summary. I hope that explains that more or less.
Okay. Sounds good. Sounds like a plan.
So let me tell you about The Good Husband. It begins very strikingly with, and in a way, I guess we should mention there's some severe trigger warning here. It begins with a scene.
We'll put that in the show notes too.
We'll put that, yes. It begins with a scene of a suicide. It begins with a scene of a suicide with a woman in a bathtub. She's slit her wrists. She has, some prescription drugs at the side, you know, that she's consumed a fair amount. And her husband comes in and sees her. The trick in this beginning is at first you think you know where this is going. You know, this is a horrible scene. You understand as you read further on that she has been battling with depression. She has had suicide attempts before. This is something that's happened before more than once. But as you read further, the twist, and it's just at the beginning, is that he doesn't call 911. He doesn't call anyone. He walks away and he goes back to bed and he goes to sleep, leaving his wife to bleed out in the tub. Whew. So after that beginning, he gets up in the morning and, you know, he goes about his usual ritual, goes in the kitchen, starts getting his coffee. And then he hears a sound, turns around, drops the mug. His wife is standing there, slightly dripping. She said, "Where's my coffee?" And that's where it starts to get a little weird, because no, she has not miraculously survived this suicide attempt. She is in fact dead. He now has a zombie wife. And the way he deals with his wife's transformation unfolds with ever increasing horror over the course of the story. And you begin to get a lot of it is from his point of view, the husband's point of view, Sean, but you begin to get the wife's point of view, Katie, as well. And it's an interesting point of view because you can see how much her entire thought process as a human has changed through death. And you can see that she knows that something isn't right. She's yearning towards the grave. There are scenes later in the story where she's literally trying to dig herself into the soil because she knows that this is not the way it should be. But he decides for some reason, okay, you know, I don't know what's happening here, but he cleans her up and he dresses her and he tries to almost act as if nothing has gone wrong. At one point, he still has sex with her. There's a point from her point of view later on where you kind of realize that she's actually not too thrilled about this because, as I said, mm-hmm. her entire thought process has transformed as she has gone through death. So she does not even have the same view of him. She's just seeking full death. That is her aim. And he is trying to find some kind of weird normality. He's trying to put things back as they used to be. Now, of course, a lot of this is the whole guilt of he left her to die. But then it's a very psychological story. As it goes on, you begin to understand that even while she was ill, even while there were these suicide attempts and so forth, there was still this this role he felt he had to play to create this image of normality. And that's why the title is so telling, The Good Husband. The story he tells himself is that I'm a good husband. We're a loving family. We don't leave family behind, you know, and he just like keeps telling himself these things, even though his actions begin to just become more and more warped and completely opposite to what you would think, his actions should be. I want to mention two amazing kind of turning points in me. One of them is when at one point she collects dead creatures, you know, like roadkill and what have you, because again, as I said, she's yearning towards death. So he thinks, oh, you know, I'm going to if this is what she wants, if this is what's making her happy, I'm going to do what she wants. And he kills the family cat. And next door family cat, not theirs, which is really unkind now that you think about
it. Yeah, that's where you're like, and I mean, you know, things were going off the deep end and you're like, oh, and now he's
gone
swimming out there.
Exactly.
Totally gone.
So that was like one huge kind of, you know, alarm bell of, yeah, you know, there's this, the slippery slope that he's going down has definitely gone past the point of no return. And then the other key turning point is they have a daughter, a grown daughter, who is at university. And he kind of begs her to come back home, because, and to tell the truth, it is not even really clear to me what he thinks she can do. But again, I guess this is his yearning for creating this image of normality. By this time, his wife can't even stay in the bedroom. She doesn't like to sleep on the bed. She's in the basement. She's basically like trying to dig through the basement floor to the soil. She's started to rot. She just looks like, you know, she's yearning towards death. He's trying to like create a normal life around them, and it's just not happening. And he calls their daughter into this. And she, of course, reacts very badly. You know, she's like, you know, what's going on here? And she's like, she goes down to the basement and she's like, no, this is wrong. This should not be happening. And he's like, come back here, you know, we're a family, whatever. And she just completely like nopes out of the situation very wisely, you know.
Yeah, and frankly, she's the only one who responds in a way to the situation in a way that
makes sense.
I think most readers would consider normal.
Yes.
One way, like, this is horrible, I'm running away.
And mind and you, she sees two things.
As I mentioned, I hope that her very next call is to 911.
Yeah, and she sees two things as horrible. Not just the state of her mother, not just her mother's actual physical decay and decline, because she's clearly dead. I mean, there's no mistaking this. But also the kind of almost make believe that her father has structured around the situation, where he is so clearly trying to, like, he hasn't called anybody yet. He's like trying to perpetuate this image of, you know, we're living our life as normal. And you know, we just need our daughter here, and we're going to bring her back to where things used to be. And she's like, no, what are you doing? You are as bizarre as this initial situation. The way you're behaving about this is also not right. Then from that confrontation, the ending is very ambiguous. It's sort of almost, you know, the wife is still there, slowly rotting away. He's still there, trying to live his life as if they can still be together, as if nothing is really wrong. And you almost get the feeling he's just going to do that until either he dies himself or she's dust.
Or hopefully, again, and let me just say, until the cops come.
The laughter sounds so bizarre, and I don't mean to make it sound as if it is a laughing matter.
I almost want to apologize, because we're going to laugh a lot in this episode, and it's really just a little bit of the whistling past the grave,
yes,
laughter.
Yes, exactly. That's how we deal with
it. Oh my lord, that's... Because otherwise I'd just be curled up under my bed, mm-hmm, you know, after reading these stories, frankly.
Yeah. And I really do have to say that there is, Nathan has a way of writing this protagonist doing these increasingly bizarre things in a way that kind of sucks you in at the beginning, where you're sort of like, oh, you know, I'm in sympathy with him. And then at some point you go, wait, whoa, no, I'm not part of this anymore. And then the horror is already taken hold of you. You've already got the tingling under your skin, because you got pulled along down the slippery slope so close yourself. And I think that is actually pretty masterful, when you begin to realize that you were actually not going along with the good guy, but with perhaps the villain. Yes. Anyway, so that is The Good Husband. And Kieran, what can you tell us about The Fruit of My Woman?
Okay, The Fruit of My Woman. So again, so this story comes from Korea. It's set in Korea. I believe it was written in the 1990s, 1997. And one interesting choice that the author made is there no names in this story? The husband just always refers to his wife. The wife only refers to her husband and also to her mother. So there's no proper names at all. So the husband is basically a salaryman, you know, some kind of job. He and his wife have been married a few years. They're in their late 20s, early 30s. And one morning, his wife says, "Hey, wow, look at these bruises. They don't seem to be going away. And they don't hurt or anything, but they are very striking." And his first, you know, his first instinct is to be like, "Where'd you get those?" You know, to kind of bark at her. And then he's like, "Oh, no, I should be nicer about this." But you can already start to see just that little bit of
you the weird dynamic. Asshole.
And it ends up getting worse. This let's call it a skin condition to begin with. It gets worse, and she's like, "Well, do you think I should go to the hospital?" And he's like, "Well, you know, if it's not bothering you, then it's probably okay." And we get a little bit of backstory, him musing about their relationship, and it's him seeing this and his musing about their history. The second time, you know, she's like, "Wow, you know, these bruises are spreading. Have another look." And, you know, they're getting much worse. And she tells him, you know, "I'm not eating very much. I only want water and I'm throwing up a lot." And he's like, "Well, yeah, you know, yes, go to the hospital." And here at least he's a little bit, you know, more on top of things than poor Sean was. At least this guy says, "Yes, go to the hospital." Mm-hmm. Well, one interesting thing when she comes back from the hospital, she's like, they said they couldn't find anything. Couldn't find anything wrong. Let's see. One nuance that kind of flows throughout the story is that it turns out through the kind of flashbacks, she never wanted to settle down. She had very much wanted to travel and instead ended up settling down with him. So there's that that tension that's building up through the story at this point. Mm-hmm. Well, he realizes things are getting worse. She's losing a lot of weight. She's looking, worse and worse. She's having more trouble talking. He's about to leave for a week-long business trip, and he's like, "Call your mother, go to the doctor." But he still leaves. He just like, okay, and leaves for a week and then comes back. And when he comes back, the place is a mess. He can tell she's not gone because her clothes and shoes are there, but there's food rotting in the kitchen. And again, instead of being terrified, "Oh my God, is my wife dead in one of the rooms in our apartment?" He's like, "Oh, there's nobody here for me to talk to. There's nobody here to ask me how my trip was." And again, you might be an asshole if, but he finally hears her moaning and she's gone out to the balcony and she's basically immobile. Things are sprouting from her and she's turning into vegetation. She's turning into a plant. Mm-hmm. Now at that moment, the one thing that he is able to do for her at that point is bring her water. So, you know, yay, go husband. At that moment, now we get a scene from her perspective, and it's addressed to her mother, not to him, and it's her musings. And this is after she's turned into a plant. And it's, as I mentioned to Karen when we were talking about the story offline, you know, in both these stories, it's only after the woman has transformed, mm-hmm. and honestly, to most part, loses her real voice, that they get a voice in the story. Mm-hmm. And that's especially striking here, is that she loses her voice physically and then gains her perspective in the story. So we get her background, and she's becoming more and more of a plant. She's like, "Well, he's been so kind. He did plant me in a flower pot and, you know, spends more time with me and gets me mineral water." And that's an interesting parallel between the two stories. We'll probably talk about a little bit more later, is that how solicitous the husbands become, how quote unquote kind they are, mm-hmm. after their wives have transformed into these, you know, you could frankly use the word grotesque, mm-hmm. creatures, although you do not get as much of that sense of grotesqueness in Fruit of My Woman. Honestly, the descriptions of her as she becomes a plant, the man and the narrative start using much more positive and elegant descriptions.
Yeah, he thinks of her as beautiful. It's just amazing.
Right. So we learn more about the wife's own perspective of especially having never been happy and honestly having some fairly violent thoughts that he's certainly not privy to, that he couldn't even imagine of her, and a little bit of you know, how sort of soul-sucking it was for her to settle down, and also how much that doctor at the hospital really just blew her off.
Yep.
It's all in your head.
Yeah, it was pretty much an "it's all in your head" visit, mm-hmm. And I think almost any person, but especially women who have dealt with chronic illnesses, have experienced that kind of dismissal from the medical establishment. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, she's outgrowing the flower pot, and it's also becoming winter. This story in particular moves from spring through to winter. And I think The Good Husband pretty much actually happens at the end of winter coming into spring, which is a little bit interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, she withers away. She like a flower might, she fruits and then withers. And at the end, you go back to his perspective. He did try to love her as a plant, mm-hmm. And tried to take care of her. When he sees the fruits, he eats one, which is, let's just say, creepy. Mm-hmm. And in a really telling line, you know, the first thing that my palate picked up was an acidic, almost burning flavor, and the juice that clung to the root of my tongue had a solely bitter aftertaste. And yeah, I again, we'll talk a little bit more about the characters and how the I'm betting we'll end up talking at least a little bit about how the descriptive language supports the characterization so perfectly in both mm-hmm. these stories. But he plants the fruits, and that's pretty much where the story ends. It's, again, it's in a very ambiguous ending. Mm-hmm. I believe that the wife is dead, but he does point out, when spring came, would my wife sprout again? Would her flowers bloom red? You know, what will happen with these fruits that have been planted? I just didn't know. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
So yeah, these stories work in parallel. Just amazingly.
Yeah. Do you know, well, both of them to me, of course, the obvious metaphor is that although we're talking about a story where the wife kills herself and becomes a zombie for the good husband, and in Fruit of My Woman, where again a woman who is disaffected, who although she doesn't actually dream of suicide, she does dream it at a certain point of, we could say, self-harming. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say dream. She mentions it when she's musing to her mother. She also transforms in a way, as you say, which could lead to actual death, or at least a kind of a death, because she's no longer human. These, of course, to me are kind of obvious metaphors, even just for what a relationship or a marriage can be like. You don't necessarily have to see it as the death of the individual in the marriage. You could just see it as the death of the marriage itself and how both parties mm-hmm. deal with it. And I just had this image for both of these stories of the wife standing, looking out, trying to get across a boundary to another world, and the husband kind of keeping a hand on them, like, no, let's just pretend everything's the same. I'll bring you some water, or I'll bring you a dead cat. I'll, you know, just like, you know, that is the overall image I have for both of them.
Well, in both of them, it's really clear to me, and the narrator, let's face it, the narrators in both these stories have their thumb on the scales. For one thing, they both do a very impressive thing where the writer or the author or the narrator, however you want to put it, the overall perspective of the story, the men are not good people. They are not doing the right things. But because you are getting their own...
They are, yes.
Exactly. They are convinced that they are good people and that they are doing the right things. Mm. And that balancing act of writing an asshole who doesn't know he's an asshole mm-hmm. and not making you purely hate them, because again, in both cases, you can feel some sympathy.
You're with him for a bit. You're like, oh, well, you know, he's got her to go to the hospital. That's good, you know. And you're just sort of like with them at least until about maybe a third of the way to the story, or even a quarter. And then you're like, wait, hold it, no.
You're like, whoa, dude, that's not okay.
Yeah.
But in that same vein, in both stories, I feel like there's a very clear, if not precise moment, but a very clear sense that these men are sitting there going, I just don't understand why she feels this way. What can I possibly do to help her if only I knew?
Mm-hmm.
And the wife is literally telling them, this is what I need.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh gosh, if only I could understand what she needed. And you're like, Shrek, if you would just shut up and listen for a second, which of course is the core of why their relationships are so dysfunctional, is that they are two very, very deeply self-centered individuals. In both cases where the wife's transforming into a plant or the wife is becoming a zombie, they're like, oh, why has this happened to me? What's happening to my wife? What's happening to this person? It's, oh, why is this happening to me? And the self-centered language, again, just in terms of the diction that the author uses, it comes across very, very clearly.
Mm-hmm. And then this whole kind of construction of an attempt at normality. I mean, when you think about the fact that, you know, your wife is turning into a plant, so you put her in a flower pot. I mean, wouldn't you call her mother? Wouldn't you, like, try to find somebody to help?
Again,
wouldn't you
take neither her of them... to a hospital?
neither of them went to the outside, except for Sean and the good husband finally, like, turning to his daughter, thinking that she would help to restore or at least reinforce the normality he was trying to get back to. Their reactions were very much, I can fix this. I can do this. You know, I'm gonna make her comfortable. And just sort of like doing things which are like, I mean, putting his wife into a flower pot on the one hand is kind, but on the other hand, she's in this flower pot. She's still yearning towards, away from the urban area that they're in, towards the sunlight, towards the things that she can't reach. So she's still bound in a way. And you know,
oh, absolutely. And her story is so tragic.
Mm-hmm. And then again, in the good husband, you know, he's content to surround her with dead things, you know, to let her eventually like sleep on the floor and dig in the dirt. But when she just wants to like get into a grave and pull it over herself, it's like, no, you can't go there. It pulls her back. So there's this real sense of still being in control of, even though the women have transformed. And one might argue transformed in an attempt at agency, in an attempt to get away from their situation. They are pulled back into their situation or some version, some warped version of their situation by that same husband.
Right. Yeah.
Gosh, that's so depressing.
Well, it is. I mean, these stories are horror, not just because they deal with the grotesque or these kind of transformations. It's horror extra because the women undergoing these still don't get what they want. They still don't get the peace or the happiness or anything that would make the stories uplifting.
They
don't. They just know. and especially the fruit of my woman. I mean, she complains early about the neighborhood that they live in and how crowded it is and the apartments and not seeing the sun. When she addresses her mother, she talks about how she specifically left the town that she grew up in because her mother had been so rooted there and she never wanted to be like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And literally, even as she, you know, transforms, she just simply ends up being more rooted.
Yes.
Like, literally, physically immobile.
Uh-huh. One of the other things that's noticeable, even though the husbands are pulling them back into the situation, they're also performing kindness a lot more strongly. There's in the Fruit of My Woman, there are hints earlier in the story that he's saying things like, you know, when last did I see my wife naked? So you get the impression that, you know, they really haven't had sex in a while and so forth. Again, with the good husband, there's also a point where it's like, you know, there's this exhaustion that he feels dealing with his wife's mental illness and, you know, and trying to have normality there. But then when she becomes a zombie, he wants to sleep with her. And then when his wife becomes a plant, I'm going between hymns. When the husband in Food of My Woman, when his wife becomes a plant, first of all, the way he describes her beauty, it's almost like, okay, wow, no, that she's never been so beautiful. I'm suddenly very interested in her now. And the way that they portray him eating that fruit, I mean, is actually such a sexual scene. Because first he says, you know, earlier in the scene, I thought about the last time I slept with my wife. And then he talks about, you know, about how she had smelled and so forth and whether she was even transforming then. But then he eats the fruit and he's smoking a cigarette and the whole sort of post-coital cigarette thing is a thing. And then it says, and savoring the smell of fresh grass that has suddenly bloomed from my wife's lower parts. And that whole bit is just so sexual. And as you said, you know, in that scene, it is ambiguous as to whether she's withered for a season or whether she's actually died. But he's just thinking about the pleasure that he has got out of this, you know? And it was so creepy and so tying back to the whole, you know, zombie sex scene in The Good Husband, where it was just like the whole focus for both of these men is my woman giving me pleasure, or is she at least performing in a way that makes me feel as if I'm giving her pleasure, which is a bit recursive, but do you understand what I'm saying? Deriving pleasure from feeling that you're giving somebody else pleasure. And not wanting to know if you're not doing what they want or if you're hurting them or whatever. You just don't even care about that. Just like, you know, tell me I'm being a good husband. Tell me I'm bringing you the water you want. You like the flower pot and, you know, aren't you a beautiful plant and doesn't your fruit taste lovely? That's the kind of the thing you're getting out of it, which is terrifying because, you know, to me, it's no surprise that their transformations mean a reduced communication, like the communication is actually completely deteriorating. But the metaphor is more, just as you said, on the men's side, they are themselves not listening. So that their image of their wives becomes so clearly a thing that cannot communicate is not surprising.
Right, and both of them, there are scenes in both, and again, we're just going to plaster trigger warnings on this,
yes,
on the show notes for this one. But there are scenes in both, even before the woman transforms in the Fruit of My Woman. He's like, well, you know, I she goes to bed early, and I get home late, and you know, when I roll over, you know, I can't quite tell if she's awake or not while we're having sex. It's like, really?
Oh, gosh.
You can't, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And in The Good Husband, when is it okay, she hasn't gone to the graveyard yet. But she has just found out that she can't tolerate light. Mm-hmm. And he makes a bed up for her down in the cellar. And yeah, they go at it like, or he goes at it like a, you know, high schooler. He's just so in, oh, what do you say? Arousal is so accentuated by these new circumstances. Mm-hmm. And the narrative is like, and by the end, she's gave up any pretense and she was just laying there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a line at some point, and the two things kind of go together. She says, I'm going to go out. And this is while she was still a little bit more verbal. And he was like, well, I'll go with you. And she's like, no. And then, where is it? She said she would have felt guilty
mm-hmm.
previously because he was a fragile man. And here we go. Once she would have felt guilty for that, she would have chastised herself for failing to take into account his wishes or his fears, for failing to protect his fragile ego. He was a delicate man, though he did not know it. And she had long considered it part of her obligation to the marriage to accommodate that frailty of spirit.
Mm.
And she's like, but you know, I'm really feeling a separation from that now.
Yes, yes.
And then after that last time that they have sex, she looks back at her husband and now pretty much referring to her husband as an it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, and I am never going to let it touch me that way again.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so... how to put it, it's so chilling, the extent to which, as I said, you know, there's that complete turning away from him as well. Because you really get the impression that both of these wives were so attentive in their own way to their husbands, had so kind of, you know, put a part of their own needs aside to be able to tend to their husband's needs. So that kind of complete reversal of role, where you're just like, no, you know, I'm not doing this anymore, is really something very, very striking. Right. Now, when you were reading that, you know, what she said about her husband, there was something later on that also really chilled me. Now, as you said, she begins to think of him less and less until he's just like it, you know, he's just like this thing that's sort of bugging her. But her memory of him is really genuinely going. And the bit that chilled me was, this other light doesn't bother you, does it, babe? She turned her head too, slowly, and looked at him. Her wounds cast garish shadows across her face in the candlelight. Hmm? Light? Oh, I know you, she said, something like relief in her voice. You're the man who left me in the water.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. And that to me was, because up to then, you know, he's carrying the guilt of leaving her to die in the bathtub. But I think that he was still able to convince himself that she didn't know he was there, that she was already unconscious and wasn't aware that he had gone in the bathroom, seen her, and just walked out again. But the way she just said it so casually, you're the man who left me in the water. That was so chilling.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up and saw you. I was scared of something. I thought you were going to help, but then you went away. What was I scared of? Do you know? I wish I could remember. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, and you know, the one that just really killed me was, so again, in The Good Husband, after that scene, she goes out at night and she goes walking. She finds a dead robin, and she thinks it's the most beautiful thing she's ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
She gets her way into a cemetery. And she, like you say, she's seeking the peace of the grave.
Yes.
Very, very specifically. And it's calling to her, and her sense of disconnection was gone. Her heart was a still lake. Nothing in her moved, and she wanted to cry from relief, and she's starting to dig. And then something awful, a tough bark, a perverse intrusion into this quiet celebration, a rape of the silence.
Yeah.
Her husband's voice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh man, and then you immediately flip to what he sees. He discovers that she's gone. He panics. He eventually thinks to look in the cemetery. He scaled the cemetery wall and called until he found her, a small white form in a sea of graves and dark grass, huddled and scared, clawing desperately in the dirt. He pulled her up by her shoulders and wrapped his arms around her. Oh, Katie, oh baby, it's okay, it's okay. I've got you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
so different what they're seeing.
So different. I mean, yeah, of each other, right? And that's, and in both of these stories, you get that duality. You do get both perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
I think, frankly, one of the things that's interesting about The Fruit of My Woman is how much of his narrative is about her. Mm-hmm. And how little of her narrative is about him,
yes.
Frankly. I mean, it, for her, it's addressed to her mother, not mm-hmm. to him. Mm-hmm. She thinks very fondly about her mother's sweater and what the smell of that was. It's a comforting object to her, not her husband's.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, usually when you think of people wearing someone else's clothes because it has a comforting smell, it's mm-hmm. your partner. Not your parent.
Well, I was actually happy and, you know, in this story that she did kind of remember her mother and sort of make her mother the focus as she became a plant more and more and couldn't speak. Because the sad thing I did find in The Good Husband is that, as Katie's memories go, it's not just her husband she's forgetting, she forgets her daughter too.
Right, and that is even more heartbreaking.
But you know, again, I look at it as such a multi-layered story that I can also see that as a portrayal of what happens when you have a parent with Alzheimer's, for example. You know, that kind of really slow, gradual decline. And so on the one hand, I looked at it as a story of, okay, this is like the death, the slow death of a marriage. But then I was like, but this could also be a marriage where one person is succumbing to dementia, is succumbing to something that takes away their personality and their ability to remember and interact with their loved ones.
That is an angle I had not considered. Yeah, that's a good point.
But I think, so
one thing you had mentioned, you weren't quite sure what the husband was going for in asking the daughter to come back. I think it all goes back to the night when Katie, quote unquote, successfully commits suicide. The last thing they'd kind of fought about was whether or not the daughter would stay at school over spring break. She really wanted her daughter to come home, and he's like, hey, you know, she's a college, doing what college kids do. Although I think now we can tell that she wanted to stay away from home at college because she just didn't want to be anywhere near their fucked up relationship, if you'll pardon me. and again, you realize that if the daughter's in college now, then some of the suicide attempts had to have happened while she was still at home. And she says that later on. She's like, you know, it was me who found mom. It was me who had to call the hospital. It was me who had to call you to come get her.
Because that's when you suddenly see the third viewpoint, you know, where it's like, oh, wait a minute. This is actually what was happening, you know. He didn't tell us about this. this wasn't in his reminiscing and memories. But yeah.
So anyway, I think the reason he was asking the daughter to come home was some delusional part of his mind thought that if he could get her home, then it would make his wife, quote unquote, happy.
And I focus on that word delusional part of his mind because again, he has so abandoned the common sense of understanding just how bizarre the situation is that he has. In, you know, further denial, if Heather just comes back and she sees Heather and, you know, everything will be fine. That's some really deep denial and delusion. Seriously.
When your wife's foot has fallen off, seeing her daughter anymore is no longer going to help.
You know, which is when you really do start wondering about his mental health situation, honestly. But, and as we said, Heather seems to be the only one with the normal reader response to the whole situation.
Yes. So yeah, and also by the way, the other role that Heather plays is confirming for us that this is not simply metaphorical, that this is a real. Yeah, basically, the zombification is real. It is not simply a product of either of their imaginations. You have this third actor come into the situation and you know react as, you know, to the physicality
of
it.
You say that, but when you read it, Heather doesn't really go into detail of what she's seeing. What she's seeing horrifies her, but she could just as easily be horrified by an actual live woman in the state of, you know, scrabbling in the dirt of the basement. So you see what I'm saying?
Well, that's a good point. And also, actually, there was a moment in that ending where I wasn't sure if one description was of the wife of Katie or if it was of her collection of dead animals.
I'm quite sure that anything from his point of view is, you know, she's definitely a zombie. And I shouldn't make it sound as if I am actually saying that she's not a zombie. I'm quite convinced she is. I mean, this is Nathan. She is probably a zombie. But in the sense of how does Heather view it? Because, you know, Sean has already proven himself to be quite the unreliable observer and listener and the narrator. Unreliable on all counts. And it's a fairly dark basement. And Heather could really be mostly just reacting to, how has my father got my mother down in this place, in the dirt, in this condition? She's not necessarily close enough to see detail. So, but I'm just spitballing. Let's still hope she calls 911.
Yes. Well, and interestingly enough, I mean, similarly speaking, if the doctor was to be any kind of that third actor, either confirming or not the physical reality of the situation, you know, this could be purely psychological, because the doctor's like, nope, looks good to me. I can still find your kidneys and your uterus and all those things.
Yeah.
It's all in your head.
But I actually like that.
So you don't get like quite as much of the validation in that story. Yeah.
You know, it could indeed, at least from certain points of view on the outside, be seen as something psychological that's happening, but it's a folie à deux. It's both of them in a shared delusion. Two husband and wife in a shared delusion of a suicide leading to zombification, or a husband and wife in a situation where some form of depression or whatever is leading to you know, anorexia and turning in and then imagination that you're a plant. So there's just enough of it, and to me that adds to the horror. There's just enough of it for you to think, oh my goodness, you know, he could be doing something, like he could be doing something helpful, but in a way he's almost sort of perpetuating it.
Right. And of course, you know, me being, you know, my how do you say, my genre roots are science fiction, right? And so you could rewrite either of these stories, take the same premise and rewrite it in a science fictional way, at which point this is happening, your relationship really is this fucked up, but the next thing you do is take your partner to some kind of medical facility and go, what is happening? There must be a reason that this person is turning into a plant, or this person is turning into a zombie, and let's, you know, let's treat this as a science fictional problem. That does not happen here. And again, partly it doesn't happen there. It doesn't need to happen there. It's not a critique of the story that it doesn't. But it, to me, it's one of the things that puts it firmly in a weird category.
But doesn't it also,
you know, dark,
echo
weird,
how abuse
new weird fiction
act? They isolate. They isolate.
Yes.
So, you know, something serious is happening with you, and it's like, oh no, you know, I can't tell the people. They take you away from me. You know, we're happy as we are. I can handle it. I can fix this.
No, Sean's behavior becomes more and more classically abusive as the story progresses, which makes you wonder what had his behavior been like before the night in question.
Heather gave us quite the hint.
And of course, you know, with even the slightest challenge from Heather, you know, Sean immediately turns to anger, which is his knee-jerk response. Because again, he is not the nice guy that he wants to believe he is.
And again,
and that's the same thing Fruit of My Woman too, right? She's like, wow, look at these bruises. He's like, how could you get bruises
it
like this?
Badly on him.
Like, wow.
Yeah. Both of them really are stories about a husband saving face. You know, nobody on the outside can know how messed up things are on the inside.
Although they are both stories that way, although neither of the husbands consciously dwells on that. They're not thinking about, oh, what must the neighbors think, but they're so invested in their stories of themselves, of their stories of their relationship being in being quote-unquote normal. So I completely agree with you, but they're keeping up appearances, but it's not necessarily keeping up appearances to the outside, it's keeping up appearances
so that's
to themselves.
Two layers of deception then. First, deluding themselves, and then, you know, also deluding outsiders. But, you know, the subconscious still has to know, or else you wouldn't have the isolation thing. Because they know that when the third party comes in, the third party may tell them something they don't want to hear.
No, definitely.
Yes.
So, in summation, these are
marvelously creepy stories.
You know, yes, very, very creepy. I don't know. Can I say they're two really, brilliantly fucked up stories?
Because it's true. And I cannot say this too often. The language for both of them is really beautiful. Like, there's something particularly, like, marvelously twisted about portraying these horrible things with such amazingly beautiful language. So you're seduced by the language. You're reading this thing and you're just like, This is horrible. I don't want to know this. But he's written it so well. Darn.
And the way they both have of making horrific things beautiful and beautiful things horrific, which is a, you know, classic Shirley Jackson kind of move. I've read both of these stories three times now, and I keep being amazed by the choices that the authors make.
Yeah.
I mean, on a level of craft, they're both absolutely absolutely worth reading and absolutely worth rereading.
By the way, this is more of a side comment. We have the author and the translator for The Fruit of My Woman is, they're both women, and Nathan is a man. And I was wondering whether you found any kind of difference or contrast or anything like that in terms of how the protagonists were portrayed, how the husbands were portrayed, how the wives were portrayed. Was there anything that kind of filtered through that you could say this author was of, you know, looking at it from the wife's perspective more, from the husband's perspective more?
I mean, I wouldn't say so. I was actually kind of amazed, especially when I realized that the author, Fruit of My Woman, was a woman. I was amazed that they had both made the same, you know, extremely similar choices of how to render the husband unsympathetic. They were both, you know, they both didn't listen. They both were very selfish. They both thought much more about sex than was warranted.
And the similar,
You know, I felt those commonalities.
And the similar portrayal of the wives as well. You know, both Katie and the wife in The Fruit of My Woman are so much more looking beyond their husbands now, looking outward. And you know, and that was echoed as well. It was a cheeky question because I already kind of knew the answer, and I just mentioned it because so many times you get situations of, you know, various levels of writing the other, and of course at the foundation of writing something that is not you is the empathy to put yourself into your character's shoes, and that's why I think both of them carry the reader along at the beginning of the story thinking, yeah, this husband's a good guy. Wait, whoops, you know, because they are so good at that. They are so good at completely getting you into the person's skin, even if that skin is the skin of somebody who is lying to themselves, who is deluding themselves about who they truly are.
Okay, so I think with that, we should probably wrap this one up. Like I say, absolutely, thank you very much for pointing me to these stories. Horror is not my usual beat, but I am very glad to see it's so well done. So, in excellent news, we are going to be able to bring you, an interview with Nathan Ballingrud. So, that should come out fairly shortly on the heels of this recording. And so we really look forward to Nathan and about this story.
So not only are we going to grill him about the story and the choices he made, but we're also going to ask him what he's up to these days, because he has a new collection coming out, and one of his stories has already been made into a film and has been at the Sundance Film Festival, and all sorts of marvelous things are happening with it. So we are going to ask him to give us some more details on that.
Excellent. So that's a little bit more to look forward to. So that's a little bit more to look forward to there. Okay, so I think with that, we will call it good, and we will catch you in just a little bit with another episode with another interview. So looking forward to it.